Hi, I'm Adnan Mahmutovic, and this is Love and its Discontents podcast. I'm really happy to introduce you to today's guest, John Austin, who is an interactive designer, independent researcher, author, filmmaker, cultural critic, and entrepreneur. Yes, you heard that right. That was quite a list.
Yes.
For over 15 years, I thought this was really interesting. For over 15 years, John has worked in augmented reality or virtual reality. And also for 2 years, he divided his time living between the U.S. and Japan, where he helped found Autism Family Networks. That was especially cool, the way you were using your skills for something like that. As someone who has worked in care myself, I find that's really admirable.
Thank you.
John Austin founded Fresh Pulp Magazine, which is dedicated to, he calls it theoretical science fiction, from marginalized communities. He also leads Dark Matters, which is a weekly podcast discussing the latest sci-fi series through a critical race lens. I also want to mention that he has written How to Be Black and Muslim in America. And this title really, I think, drew my attention, and I think everyone else will be interested in this: Practical Approaches to Space Travel for Muslims. That sounds really cool. That sounds like an entire episode.
Are you right?
just to talk about that. So he has made short films. He has also won the Comcast Award for short films in 2008 for The Jersey Devil. John, welcome to Love and Its Discontent.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here, and I'm looking forward to having a discussion with you.
So, today I invited you to talk about a series, Shogun, based on James Clavell's novel. I felt like, this is the story that I have been familiar with and, a fan of since I was a kid. So back in Bosnia before the war, I, of course, watched Shogun with Richard Chamberlain, the original adaptation. I think everyone loved that.
Yes.
And then I revisited that show later when we could buy these, fancy DVD boxes. So watched it again. Then again, it was like rediscovering this. There was a lot of nostalgia for me, feeding into that revisiting of that series. So when I saw that the new adaptation was coming out, I was curious about that. It looked awesome in trailers and all that. And so I watched it recently, and I felt I was burning to talk about it with someone. Like I really wanted to talk about this show, both from the point of view of someone who is an academic and a writer. So the point of view of what it deals with, but also the point of view of craft, and of course the specific topic of love for this podcast. So I was so lucky to have found you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
I was thinking that we start speaking a little bit more generally about the show first, and see it, to hear your impressions, what you liked and maybe what you disliked, and how you how it relates to the old adaptation. When I watched the trailer and when I started watching the series, at first I was a little bit skeptical about the choice of the actor for the main character. I suppose because I grew up watching Richard Chamberlain, and he was such a character, handsome and
yes,
lots of charisma and all that, and nothing against this actor. He's a good actor, but at first I was like, no, that doesn't really work for me. Eventually, I would understand, I would like his role because he wouldn't take over so much from the Japanese characters. I think that that was the effect I had, that his being not so impressive. I felt that all the other characters came to the fore a lot more, so that there was not, but still, you know, I had to mention this because I think I was probably biased. Yeah,
I actually agree with you. I agree with you because, I actually avoided watching Shogun for the longest time, and mainly because of my sort of loyalty to the original from when I was a kid, because, you know, and also my view of this story has also shifted, right? Because the original was very much about Blackthorn, right? In other words, the Japanese characters seem to be bit players in their own story. Whereas, and so I was like, oh, do I really want to watch another, you know, like, is this Orientalist? Like, do I really want to watch this again? You know, so... And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to take a peek at it. And I started watching it. And I was like, wow, this is really well done. And Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays Toranaga, his performance just was fantastic. And I want to sort of, because I also taunted everybody who was like posting about it, you know? And I was like, you know, you guys really love Hiroyuki Sanada, but you guys forget that Toshiro Mifune was like the original, right?
Yes,
like the 1950s, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Anyway, and people have been in love with him since The Last Samurai. Anyway, and so when I saw that, number one, the performance that he delivered, because it was not just nuanced, it was so subtle, right? Everything down to his facial expressions were perfect. Or the lack of facial expression, right? Sometimes you get a tiny little smirk out of him, you know? And I was just like, wow, he's really killing this role. Hiroyuki Sanada's performance was fantastic. The woman who played Mariko, I think her name is Anna Soama, I think. Hers was phenomenal. Really everyone. I think the all Japanese cast, it was beautifully filmed. The sets were perfect. The CG was... you know, it was flawless. So I enjoyed it.
I couldn't agree more. I was stunned by absolutely everything from the first second until the last, you know, the perfection of, you know, the level of detail or, you know, they put into the sets, the clothes, the scenes, the building of the narrative, color, absolutely everything. But as you say, the acting especially was the highest quality I have seen in a long while, like,
yes,
across the board. I'm thinking, okay, usually there is someone who is, you know, really good, and then, you know, that's important, you know, the main character or, you know, a couple of characters. But here everyone was really flawless in terms of like what they needed to deliver, and delivered it absolutely perfectly. As you said, there were these subtleties that were just uncanny, that was so,
yep,
almost creepily good.
Yes. I think one of the interesting things about this too is that, and this may be lost on some viewers, but Japanese is a language and a culture of extreme subtlety. And so in parting that, right, because, you know, as a writer, you have to write that subtlety, and you have to write it in a way that even if it's lost on the person watching, it still is a convincing performance. And that was what shocked me the most was, it was, you know, for me, and just as an example, a small example was the scene where Mariko was negotiating with the courtesan over the price. There was this subtlety about the cup and everything, and I was like, wow, they really included that. Which I can get into, you know, more detail a little bit later. But yeah, they really, the writers just, you know, did a fantastic job.
And I think even if you don't know all the cultural details and subtleties, you can still feel the great attention, the great care they put into this. I think that comes across, even if you don't pick up on certain details. Almost insanely, I felt it, I couldn't, this is not something I could binge watch, I needed to digest, you know, I need to do it old school. I need to watch like an episode and then take my time digesting it and then moving on to the next episode.
Yeah.
This hasn't happened to me in a while, I have to say.
It's a lot to process, right? Yeah. Very dense. And I think also, not just the writing, but like the thing that really captured my attention too was how emotionally intense. There's a tension, right? Because there's this underlying belief from everyone that you could die at any moment, right? Earthquake, fire, war, disease, or just executed, right? Like you looked at this person wrong and now you're dead. And they captured that so well. I was like, oh my God, someone's going to die. Like every 10 seconds, I was like, someone's going to die.
Yes. Everything felt like really close to death. You know, they drink tea, someone's going to die. Like, perhaps, you know, one of the most intense scenes, which we'll talk about later, was between Mariko and her husband, was so tense. Like, I felt like it was worse than any, you know, killing scenes in terms of tension. Overall, and this kind of closeness to death, which is a theme throughout the entire show, right?
Yeah, I was just saying that, like, if you like, for me, I'm a big fan of like samurai texts, like, you know, Hagakure and the Demon Sermon to a Warrior, and there's a very important Buddhist monk, Shinto monk named Takuan Soho, who wrote a book called the Furochishin Myoroku, the Unfettered Way. And so I'm a big fan of the kind of Jodo Shinshu, like Buddhist style of, you know, thinking. And part of what she's talking about, the eight fence, right, existence, is she's also referring to this Buddhist idea of like the Eightfold Path and like the letting go of earthly pleasures and desires and sort of existing. And so what it really evoked for me. And that was in these samurai texts, they talk about being prepared for death in service to your Lord, right? Because it's the highest, greatest preparation you can make, you know? And so that tension that they imbued the show with really captured that. Like, I was so impressed by it. So, yes.
And they kept that throughout, like from the first moment until the very last, in the building of the narrative. Like, you think, okay, in the beginning, there's one guy who, you know, stands up for his Lord, and then he has to commit suicide. He has to kill his baby as well, you know, and that huge sacrifice. And if that wasn't enough, you know, like one by one, you know, these moments of sacrifice throughout until the very, you know, that big scene with Mariko when she is trying to get out of the, and that sacrifice that she makes for her Lord. I felt that there was, as a viewer, we were schooled or taught this art with Anjin Sama.
Right.
Because he develops to understand how that actually works.
Yeah. And it's funny how he, like, there's this sort of dichotomy in him. And it was really the most interesting part about him. It wasn't his boorishness as a barbarian. It was constantly having to hold these conflicting ideas about life being cheap versus constantly being prepared himself to throw himself in harm's way to save Torinaga. And it's like, you're doing the same thing everybody else is doing, right? Right? So like, but you think that you're doing it. And this also this illusory and really illusion, this illusory idea of freedom, right? This idea that, you know, like when Mariko says to him, you know, until you are free of this idea of freedom, you will never be free of yourself. And I was like, wow. And it captured, it's one of the things that I was glad that you asked me to do this podcast, because so much of modern civilization is hyper-individualistic, right? Even Japan is being sort of, in modern times, is being nibbled away at by sort of Western ideas about hyper-individualism. And I'm not going to lie to you, I lament that a little bit, right? Like, I'm sorry sometimes to see it happening.
Oh, I understand that, definitely. And I also love that they really showed this this kind of intense intimacy, and that you know, from Anjin's point of view, you death is kind of meaningless, and you want to kind of you don't want, you know, most deaths that he observes seem meaningless to him, So whereas, as you say, he is ready to throw himself in harm's way for people from the beginning, like so many times, almost unexpectedly so. And yet doesn't understand how it functions. Yeah.
Yeah, I think like it's I think the dichotomy or the conflict comes from the subtlety of quiet service that the Japanese are accustomed to. It's expected, as opposed to, you know, valorizing oneself and draping oneself in honor. I was really glad they, and it's funny because I saw a lot of people on Twitter talking about the guy killing himself and killing his baby, and I can't believe that they're going to do this. And I mean, they were really shocked by the culture. And one of the things I kind of had to explain to some people is that I'm not justifying killing a baby, by the way, right?
Like, exactly. Yes.
But you have to understand that that's a very ordered civilization, and it's remained ordered for the past 600-700 years, yes. Right? And so it's like this idea of absolute obeisance, this absolute loyalty, it had to be ingrained because those people, like Mariko said, fires, earthquakes, war, famine, whatever, you're never going to survive all that if you have a bunch of people who are freelancing, right? That's all have to be committed towards the same objective.
That's absolutely right. And all the, you know, the English, the Portuguese, all of them are freelancers. The priests, all of them have come, you know, to nibble at this place and get something out of it, you know. And the way it resists, I think it's beautifully shown. My favorite scene was the scene of the earthquake.
Yeah,
that was so realistic. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, so realistic, not just in terms of like the way they showed the earthquake, but also the way Anjin, you know, hurls himself down and tries to save Lord Toranaga, who is buried under earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His reaction to being unearthed was priceless, right? Yes. He gets out of the dirt and he looks and he sees Anjin-san, and his reaction is almost like, how did I know it was going to be you, right? Yes. How did I know if I got out of this, I was going to be staring at your face, right?
Yes.
But there's another cultural subtext that I think either may have been edited out or just may have been missed, which is the gift of these swords that Anjin-san made to Toranaga, which is that these are two swords which, even though his consort believed were very valuable, Mariko kind of told him, like, look, these are the swords of essentially a coward, right? And so, and you would think that that gift would be meaningless, but it's not, right? Because Toranaga obviously is aware. But what he does, in essence, by giving these swords to Toranaga, is he's re-imbuing them with the honor that they should have had, right? Now, Toranaga has the swords, they're his, they belong to his consort's, you know, father, and now they're like in this place of honor. That's a big deal, right? Like, even though she's unaware of the treachery of her father or the cowardice, it's like, you know, his dishonor has kind of now been absolved,
right? And it took something as big as an earthquake to actually redeem, for the redemption. I mean, symbolically, that is huge. That in itself shows how big that is, right? Yeah.
But also, I think, too, because she was at that moment, she says, don't you understand? And right when she says that, the earthquake hits.
Yes.
And like for a moment after he rushes into the chasm, I was like, he gets it. Like, this had to be a really big lesson.
Yes.
You know, and so that was like, and it wasn't hokey or crude. The way it was done really well. Like, I was like, this could not have come at a better time, right? Earthquake.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, because it's not like one of those, oh, you know, we're going to have like a big scene, you know, earthquake, you know, something big, symbolic, because it's the thing is that it's so charged and so meaningfully symbolic because it's also real. It is absolutely real. It's not just some gesture, right? To show this, the return of the honor. That's anchored in the kind of raw reality of the world.
Yes, and I think it also, because you know, Mariko is also really like everybody's really concerned for Toranaga, and rightly so, because they all recognize that their fates are tied to his, and it's like
hey, you know what? We're all going to be taken up by this earthquake. And if he dies, we're all going to be committing suicide by morning, right? Like, and I know that it's not, they probably weren't consciously thinking that, like, oh, he's our meal ticket. But I think that because their connection to him has been so ingrained, and really that's how Japanese society is, right? Your connection to the other, your desire to do more for the group than for yourself, it's so thoroughly ingrained in you that, you know, that, yeah, rushing into the chasm probably made sense, you know?
It made so sense, and I love that that Anjin, and you know, that he gets it instinctively at an instinctive level, yeah. Whereas in his mind he doesn't quite get it. You know, hasn't right. really articulated it, but you know, this kind of almost muscle instinct reaction,
muscle memory, right?
Muscle memory, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I and kind of getting into the themes about love, which is these things that people again believe are kind of conflicting or at odds in Japanese culture. This idea of love for one's civilization, one for one's community. You know, there are concentric circles of love, right? There is specific love, and the truth is, in 17th century Japan, the idea of specific love, of specificity, of loving a single person, probably was far less important than loving your larger family, your clan, your town, your village, your community, your country, right? Especially in the upper class, because you were more or less told to marry a certain person, and it was based upon political advantage.
Indeed, there is a hierarchy of loves throughout, and they are all acknowledged as existing, but there is a hierarchy. You know what comes first and then second and so on. So you follow that line. So you don't start with this romantic love and, you know, leave your husband and, you know, it's so nice that we met each other and we there is synergy and there's good chemistry between us. Yeah.
Okay, so am I the only person who finds a sort of romanticism in that kind of love? Like, to me, the idea that you can, I love the idea of being able to dedicate and devote yourself to another person wholly. That's a great thing, and it's a great thing to be in, you know, to not just be someone's lover or whatever, but to be in service of that person for a lifetime. But I also love this idea that of people who are community minded. I love the person who I see who loves their community, who would sacrifice for their community, who would serve their community. That no task is too small, is too menial. That kind of thing is the thing that evokes affection in me when I see that in other people. So when I watch, because I'm a big fan of Japanese dramas, right? Not dramas, but like I watch a lot of Japanese movies and, you know, and shows. And when I see that, I'm like, man, you know, because it's so, again, and maybe I'm just sort of jaded, but I kind of lament, I dislike this hyper-individualism. Right. I dislike it. I dislike this idea that it's like me and it's all about me and I'm going to find somebody who serves my needs and like whatever. Like, I really dislike that. And so when I watched Shogun, I was like, oh, this is such a relief to like to see people who actually give a crap about each other.
That's absolutely right. And this really resonates with me because I also feel that any kind of a love needs to be grounded in community. Of course, there are different sizes of community and different kinds of community, but it needs to kind of, because then it feels authentic, then it feels genuine. So this kind of romantic love that, for instance, grows between Anjin and Mariko becomes for me authentic in the end because it arises from that commitment that they that she has throughout, and then and which he learns to adopt or develop.
Right, and it's funny too because there was a point where I actually sympathize with her husband, right?
Yes,
because
yeah, that's right.
He inherited, you know, essentially a quote unquote burden, and I had to remind myself that, you know, because he when he was talking to Tonanaga, he said that, you know, she's just been ice since the day that we met, and the thing that I, you know, and also because she sort of was in that space of kind of wanting to kill herself. And so I felt like that in that moment, I felt so bad for him. I was like, man, that's gotta be rough. Right. And like, she's being so attentive towards Anjin-san, but then I kind of snapped out of it. And I was like, you are angry because you feel entitled to her affection, right? That's what you, that's really, like, your ego is really wrapped up in this. And yeah, she's been ice towards you since the beginning, but the truth is, did you really make any attempt aside from your expectation of her fulfilling her marital duties? Did you do anything to, like, thaw the ice? You know, like, I'm just going to be a great warrior and she's going to love me. Like, it was, you know, so once I got the subtext of that, and I still liked him. I still wanted to like him because I still felt like, even though he hit her, which really bothered me, it really triggered me.
Yes, absolutely. That triggered me as well. Yeah.
Like, I felt sorry for him because he was trapped in his own body. You know what I mean? Like, he's the only person who's ever, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And despite all of his prowess as a warrior, as a person, he was just, you know, a child, essentially.
He most definitely was. And also the way he represented, one kind of... You know, he had a really bad conception of love, just as Anjin had a bad conception of love to begin with. So she was like teaching both of them a lesson.
Right.
So it was for her, whoever learns this lesson, I think she would be prepared even for that tea ceremony she has with him. Mm-hmm. That, in a sense, I think she would be prepared to accept him, you know, had she understood. Right. And when she tells him in the end, well, you really don't get it. You know, you don't understand all that stuff about, you know, love, freedom, honor, all those things you think of in a sense mechanically. Just as Anjin thinks, you know, oh, I'll just need to take you away from this cruel world, and that's romantic.
Right.
Yeah. So she's, yeah.
Yeah. I completely agree with that. And Mariko, I think from beginning to end, if we're going to talk about love, she embodied, to me, she was the embodiment of the idea of love from the specific all the way up to the national community. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, everything about her was about, you know, devotion. And the interesting thing too, is that the idea of seppuku, of suicide, is either very selfish or very unselfish, depending on the context, right? Because Kiyama wants to kill herself, right? But Torunaga's like, no, you got to stay alive so you can serve me, right? And Mariko wants to kill herself, but Torunaga was like, no, you have to stay alive so you can serve me. So it's like, but on the other hand, the husband in the very beginning, I guess it's Kiyama's husband, like, yeah, he has to kill himself and their baby because he has to sacrifice for the good of his lord. And it's like, for somebody who's uninitiated, that has got to be really confusing.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, it must be really confusing, because it's again, as you said in the beginning, it's so much about subtlety and context. You really need to pay attention. You really need to be open to learning and observing and picking up on signs and throughout. Yeah.
I do want to make a clarification, if you don't mind.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Yes.
Is because people really, there are a lot of people who really didn't understand why Kiyama's husband killed himself and their son. And part of why he did it is because he insulted Ishido. But also the other reason why he did it was he dishonored his lord. But there's also another element, which is his lord was in the middle of a very delicate political machination, a maneuver, and he interrupted that. And what it did was it limited his lord's ability to maneuver, right? He basically made a tactical error that could have cost Torunaga his life, right? And so now, and people say, okay, he has to kill himself, right? Why did he have to kill his son? Because he's now dishonored his entire line, and his son would grow up, if he were to grow up, his son would grow up as having carried that shame. And it's like preferable in their eyes for him to be dead than to grow up as an outcast and to be shunned.
Because he would be.
So I want to make that clear.
Yes, he would be living hell.
Yes, it would be a living hell. Yeah. But I also want to make the distinction very quickly between seppuku and harakiri. Okay, because okay, a lot of people
ahead,
don't.
Go ahead, do that. Please,
so there are a lot. There are a lot of people who are like, "What's the difference?" It's station. Primarily, it's station and it's custom. Okay, Harakiri is so seppuku is more ritualistic, right? And there's preparation that's made for it, right? And there are protocols of observance, right? Harakiri is more like generally suicide, right? So if I were to just pull out a gun and shoot myself, that would be considered Harakiri, right? But if I were to sit down and have the washi and wrap my blade in it and put the blade in my stomach and then I have somebody waiting behind me with the sword, that would be seppuku. And in most cases, it's reserved, at least at that time, was reserved for specific castes. So if you were of a noble caste or a samurai caste, you would be accorded that honor, right? Even in dishonor, as opposed to someone who's a commoner, there would not be all of this pomp and circumstance surrounding it.
Well, thank you for that clarification. I think that's really important for the context, because there are several scenes with seppuku, both, you know, similar and different. It starts, of course, with that first sacrifice of the, as you say, because there is a plot of Lord Taranaga has this plot which no one knows what it is, you know. Everyone suspects that there is a plot, that he has planned things out. No one knows even what kind of character they are in that plot. So
right,
that's like
right.
A big mystery until the very end. No one knows no one knows whether or not there is a plot, and if there is one, who is playing what part, right?
So except the tea house madam. The tea house madam suspects. She was like, okay, so you just let 10,000 troops march into your, like, are you serious, dude?
Yes.
Like, yeah, yes. She's, go ahead.
That's great. Yeah, I love that scene when she comes in and says, well, I read you. I think I read you well. Of course, he's not going to admit that.
Sure.
But maybe, you know, there is a little bit of I think he's probably a little bit happy that someone did say that.
Understands him, right?
Understands him.
Which is also like, and that's the thing about courtesans. And another distinction I want to draw is between courtesans and prostitutes, because Blackthorn refers to her as a prostitute on several occasions. He even uses the word whore, I think, at one point. So a whore in 17th century London or a prostitute would be like, you pay them some shillings and then you go into an alleyway and you have sex real quick. Courtesans, first of all, sex is not a foregone conclusion. You pay them, but at least in the modern sense, like geisha, for example, they don't have to have sex with you, right? It's not a requirement. And really what you're doing is you're paying them for their company. And courtesans, you know, in those days, it was probably a little bit different, but courtesans, they're usually educated in music and poetry. They are usually very well versed in current affairs and politics, because their job is not to go into a back room and have sex with you for an hour and then you leave, right? It's an all-night experience. When you go to see a courtesan in Japan, you're there and they're pouring your tea and they're talking to you, and you may mention something about, you know, the silk trade prices or whatever, and she'll know. She'll be like, oh, it must be very troubling for my lord to have to pay an extra 4% interest on his usury.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like I want to make that like clear that they're not only educated, but they're in many ways a respected profession.
Oh yes, absolutely. That's and that is, I suppose, shown through Mariko's negotiation over the price, and you see, you know, the value, and she's trying to kind of lower the value, or you know, get the courtesan a little bit cheaper, because in a sense, the man who is getting the courtesan is really not worthy of her.
Right.
I think that's the point, right? So she's like,
right.
Okay, well, can I get someone cheaper? You know, because he's really not that important in this case. Yeah.
And that's sort of the important part of the scene with the teacup, right? There is a ritual that is involved, or there is a protocol involved with serving tea. And typically when the teacups are, particularly they're adorned or they're painted, most of the times the painting is facing outwards away from you, right? It's for the pleasure of the person sitting across from you to view. And I may be wrong on this, but the other thing is that it demonstrated that the courtesan knew and understood the value of things, right? Yes, she is a courtesan from a province, Izu province, which is not a central province, but she understands, oh, look, you have lacquerware, right? You must have money. You must be afford to pay me, right? But then Mariko takes the cup and puts it down facing her, and she's like, yes, but you're not of my station, and you're not in a position to demand more. You know, so there was a whole conversation happening in the subtext, right?
Yes.
A whole conversation that was not being spoken. And again, it speaks again to the genius of the writers.
Oh, definitely. And if you pick up on something like that, again, so everything becomes, you know, far more charged with meaning and tension and all these things. And also connected. That's the thing. Like, everything is so connected to everything else. It's not like, okay, one scene follows another, you know, as cause and effect. Rather, it's like, you know, a tapestry, like from the beginning until the end. So you can kind of move through it in some way. Mm.
It's one of the things that I think a lot of Westerners, even in modern times in Japan, miss in their communications with Japanese people, is they miss subtext. And Japanese is a language that is very big on subtext. There's a lot of implying without implying. And I can give you kind of a better example of this, a more modern example, but I have dated in Japan. And one of the things that it took me a while to understand eventually was, typically when you're dating a Japanese person, a woman particularly, there's, even though there's a lot of subtext to your conversations, there's a lot that if you're paying attention, there's relationships in the West are fraught because we still don't always say what we mean, but we're also kind of caught up in this idea that the other person likes us, right? But the other person who's caught up in their own ego isn't necessarily going to tell you outright. Japanese folks are different, but they still have a way of communicating to you that they're interested in you, right? So as an example, you may go out on a date, you may go to dinner, and your date may say, would you like to come up for a drink, right? There's a whole loaded subtext that I completely didn't understand for my first several months there, right? Like, I was like, oh my God. Like, I was like, oh no, I've had enough to drink, you know? And I like went home and my friend was like, are you stupid? And I was like, no, like it was just a drink. And he's like, no, it wasn't just a drink, my man. Like, you missed it. You missed the cue. And the thing is that the girl thought that I didn't like her.
Oh, she and thought so, she didn't like her. I see.
Yeah. Like, I was like, because to me, especially educated the way I was by feminists, right, which is that, you know, no means no, and that if they're offering you a drink, that's what they're offering you. They're offering you a drink. Like, that's what you're going to get, is a drink, right? And so because of that, I was like, I seriously thought that she was like, would you like another drink? And I was like, I'm way too, like, I've had enough. I'm going to go. So, and the thing is that, like, you know, also, time is important, right? If they're giving you their time,
yeah,
right? No one's going to show up for a date and spend the date with you 5 or 6 hours and then be like, yeah, I don't really like that guy. You know, they're going to be looking for a way out. Like, oh yeah, my grandma called and she's not feeling well, you know? So, but I will say also that Japan is experiencing a very similar thing to what we're experiencing here in the West, which is this crisis of relationships between, like, men and women are not digging each other. You know what I mean? Like, they're experiencing that as well. So, and I say that because I want to draw a contrast between what we witness in the show versus what we're seeing in modern times. Like, there is, you know, Korea's having the same thing. Like, Korean women are literally just like, we're not going to get married anymore.
Yeah,
and
I see.
Japanese women are kind of experiencing something very similar. They're like walking away from dating.
Oh, wow.
So,
Wow, that is a huge crisis. I think that I think you can notice similarities everywhere. But picking up on those signs and those cues, I'm really glad that you explained this a little bit, especially since, you know, and to see where it comes from and how it is. Some things have remained traditionally. You know, I was thinking of these. So you said earlier how Mariko's husband never really tried, you know, And I would like us to look at some maybe details. What is it with Anjin that that makes her fall for him, or you know, start loving him? There are some scenes which I thought were really, really interesting. Not necessarily always scenes with a kind of erotic charge between them. But yeah, I'd like to hear like what you think. How was that? You know, was it like real love, and how?
I think there are a few factors. I'm so glad you asked this question, because I agonized over this. Okay. I was like, this guy's like a filthy, he's like bathed once a week, right? Like, how could you love this guy?
Yes.
number one, I think like there is a novel aspect to it, right? Which is that he's a foreigner, but I don't think that she fell in love with him because he was a foreigner. I think she started to develop feelings for him because the type of love that he represented was very different from what she'd known, right? Which is a very, and let's be clear, okay, the portrayals, let's, like, European love, right, in the 17th century wasn't any better, right? Like, people got married for many of the same reasons. Practicality, you know, to have a family, you know, it's not like today where they had Bumble and they had like a million options, right? But I think also that she saw him grow from this brash, you know, I really kind of compared it in many ways to like this really deep unconditional love that a person might have for their child, right? Because every day you see this little person become this other person every single day, this huge arc. And that's just got to make you, I mean, I don't have any kids, but I have had nieces and nephews, and I'm just like, when I see them after like a week and they say something, I'm like, wow, man, you really just grew like 10 years in like 7 days. And so I think she's this growth from this brash, unbathed, unrefined foreigner into this person who really started to figure out when to keep his mouth shut, when to bow, when to be polite, but also he still remained himself, right? He was still insistent. He was still like way more aggressive probably for Japanese taste. And so I think the fact that he could change into this person and begin to understand how and why they live while simultaneously remaining who he was, I think that was a big draw for her, you know, because despite the fact that he had changed for the better, his affection towards her was unaffected by it, right? Which made it like stronger. Do you know what I mean? It was like, she was like, wow, he understands how we're all caught up in this, and he still loves me. He's still concerned for me. And so I think she was like, she just gave into that eventually, you know, she melted into it. So that's my belief.
Well, yeah, definitely. I would agree with that. I also felt that his growth, which was, I think, surprising for many of them, but also sort of consistency in some weirdness of his character, that he is still a foreigner, and you know, but the fact that he could get them, and that he could learn in ways that none of those, you know, priests and you know, those other foreigners who were there on business and politics and all that, they never could, you know, they never learned that. They were there to conquer for real.
Yes. That's 100% correct. And I also want to kind of comment on, again, to expand on the overarching theme of your podcast, this idea of love, fraternal love.
Fraternal love, yes, please. Yeah.
Right, which is just everywhere in this show, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
The samurai cast, let's be clear, it's a fraternity, right?
Yes.
It's an elite warrior cast. And I want to also, side note, nobility and samurai cast are two separate castes. There's overlap, but being a samurai doesn't make you a noble. But nobles tend to generally be samurai. They you know, they carry swords. So you can be a bush samurai, like a bush knight in Europe, right? You could be a poor knight. It's completely possible. It does give you mobility. If you're a samurai, your chances of advancing into the upper reaches, totally possible. And also, it's important to note that samurai were not the only warriors in Japan. Okay, there were bushi. There were people who were just like conscripts. Okay, they were warriors, but they weren't conferred the title of samurai. So those people existed as well. and they relied very heavily on them as like reserve, like, you know, fodder. So anyway, going back to the Vertorni, the Yabushige, right? That whole thing, which was very fraught for like 80% of the show, right? And they kind of developed this sort of uneasy brotherhood, right? And that to me was the most obvious example, right? Because everybody else was kind of jealous and wormy and whatever, and you know, and it was also kind of the paradox where they become friends and then Yabushige basically has to die. Like, I was like, oh man,
that's,
you know,
right.
Like,
yeah. I was also so sad about his development, that he you know faded out in that way, especially because you know, for me that was probably one of the first scenes that introduced love in the show, when he falls from the cliff. Oh no, he climbs down the cliff,
yes,
right, and then ends up in water and is ready to kill himself, and this kind of surprising surge of care in Anjin about him. Like, he didn't see that coming. He didn't expect to care for this man, and that in that moment something happened, and he was like, that for me was the beginning of this fraternal love, as you call it.
Yeah. And also the fact that he like watched him draw his sword to kill himself. He was like, I just saw that guy, was he gonna kill himself? And the guy was like, better to die like on your own sword than to be tossed about in the, you know, that was a very, I agree, that was like the instantiation of their little fraternal. But also, like, if you look at this at scenes where you see some of the samurai when they're confronting each other and they're just talking, but then you see, like, a really good example is when Torinaga meets his brother Saiki and they're in the forest and they're talking, and at one point Saiki says something and one of the samurai, I think it's Wadamatsu, who's behind Torinaga, puts his hand on his sword, right? That's a very, 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 very important motion, right? And it happens a few times, but that was the most subtle the most subtle incident of it, because he's literally saying, based on what this guy says next, I'm either going to cut his head off and it's going to be a fight, or my hand's going to move, you know what I mean? And the reason why I mention that too is because in the other instances when people put their hands on their swords, you see them and everybody else around them immediately does it, right? And that is not just military training, that is brotherhood. That's like, okay, I cannot let my brother be cut down by these other guys without drawing my sword. So you see one guy put his hand on his sword and then you see everybody else do it.
Everyone,
you're just like,
does, yes. Yeah.
That's how it's quickly so, things can get out of hand, right?
Indeed, so quick. I mean, really losing life for any reason so quick that it's just incredibly like both expected and unexpected. And the way they developed it, there's so many scenes with this fraternity love throughout. I was surprised that they would that they toned down the romantic plot so much, and made this the big one, so that the romantic love would grow out of or in relation to that, would be defined by that. So many scenes with I'm thinking that, would you agree with me that when Anjin is trying to save Torinaga or is concerned about him, that it's from his point of view it's less this sense of duty? Of course he's learning that, but that it is that kind of fraternal love that he feels from the beginning, which Torinaga in a sense exploits because he's a mastermind, but there is
cold-hearted.
Yes, yeah.
He even says it to his son. He says that in this world, you only have yourself, right?
Yes, yeah.
I agree with you, and I was going to mention that also. So you took the words right out of my mouth, that there is a sort of fraternal love that I think Anjin-san feels for Torinaga. I think that Torinaga, if you think about it, right, like, yeah, it's been impressed upon him how important Torinaga is, but Torinaga, to him, that's all still meaningless to him.
Yes.
Right? So there had to be more that drew him to Torinaga besides his station. Do you know what I mean? And so I think this kind of capacity for silent or quiet generosity from Torinaga was part of what endeared him. But I think there's also an element that I want to hit upon, is that, to his credit, Blackthorne never stopped asking about his men.
He didn't.
Right. Yeah. And so there's a fraternal.
Like
yes, almost like nagging. And so I think that there was, and I think he was balancing that sort of fraternal love for Totonaga with those of his men. But when talking to Totonaga, he was constantly advocating for his men, which is another, you know, seafaring, you know, Herman Melville style
yes, yes.
fraternity, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And would you say that it just like for the sake of context, like is this fraternal love something that they that is, you know, cultivated, that it's that you, or how does it function? Because I was mesmerized by that throughout.
You know, the Japanese I'm going to answer this in the context of the Japanese, but okay. The Japanese are very frequently attributed with this level of stoicism, right? That they typically don't wear their emotions on their sleeves. It's just how, and the thing is that, you know, I've got a half Japanese mother and a Japanese grandmother, right? And that is not lost on me. Like we're all very stoic, right? My sisters are like the opposite. My grandmother's like, what is wrong with you people? but I took that, I internalized those lessons. The thing is that it's a misconception. It's just because they're not immediately like, hello, hi, how are you? Let's be friends. It doesn't mean that they don't care about anything. They're actually deeply, they're no different than anybody else in terms of how deeply they feel things. But the fact that they don't give themselves so readily to just anybody, and I mean like friendship, is what makes the friendship so valuable. I only have a few friends in Japan.
Yes.
And like I have a friend who's in a punk band, and when I first met him in the dorms when I was in school in Japan, he was a yaoi-san, he worked at a vegetable stand, and he used to bring cherries and like bananas and stuff, which by the way in Japan it's like we were crazy expensive, right?
I know.
So he would make these gifts of like fruit. And then one day he said, you know, to me, "Hey, do you want to take a bath together?" Right? This is said this to me in Japanese, and I was like, "Wait, what?" Like, you know, he didn't quite say it that way, but it was lacking context. So when he said it, I had to process it, and I was like, really? And I realized there's like a public bath in the building we lived in, and that's kind of like a thing that you do with your buddies. Is like after a long day, you come home, you take the hot soak, you know. And so we did. And the interesting thing is, you don't really even necessarily need to talk, right?
Okay.
It's just the ritual, the act, being in each other's company, right, is in itself an act of bonding. We are friends to this day. Right, and it's been 20 years, right?
That
it's been 20
so
years
beautiful.
since that fateful day in the public path. But and you know and so like the idea of building fraternity in Japan is as adults it's different than when you're like say a teenager. When you're a teenager it looks very much like how it does in America, probably worse. A lot of bullying and chasing people and stuff. When you get to be an adult, it's a little bit more thoughtful. And all of the friends that I've acquired in Japan or I've gotten have been very slow burn, Jamie, over the years. And it's never like you show up in Japan and someone's going to hug you. That's never, ever happened.
That never happened.
You know?
Okay.
No. So there's always some little act of intimacy or care that they offer that signifies to you. And again, a lot of Westerners miss that. They discount it as something that other people do just sort of normally. Whereas the Japanese are like, you know, when I receive gifts, that's a big, gift giving is a big deal, right? Like I gave a friend of mine was a very big into collecting soul records from the 70s, records of soul artists, and I found this very rare pressing from Island Soul Records in the UK, and I gave it to him as a gift, and he like was on the verge of tears, you know, like, and I was like, dude, it's just a record.
It's just a record, right?
You know,
you gave him a summarized quote.
Yeah, really. I mean. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the fact that I took an interest in something that he cared about, and that the gift that I gave him, and the thing is that gift giving is an art, right? it's not about expensiveness or whatever. It's about the thoughtfulness. And that, again, in keeping with the theme, it's about love. You know, it's about now relationships, friendships, the platonic friendships with women is a little bit more fraught, right? Because of the subtext of romance, it's always there. I mean, it is here too, but you know, I don't know. We have more clear language about that, I feel. Like, people just say, use the word friend zone.
Yes, oh, the friend zone, yeah.
Right? Like, so it's much, like, clearer here, whereas there, because so much is unspoken, it's like, huh, does that person like me or not like me? And I could like them, but I don't know if I like them. There's that whole thing, so.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, there is that fraternal thing. Right. It's just a little bit more. And also, there are things that you don't tell, typically you don't say to your girlfriends in Japan, you know? Like, you don't go to and be like, I went out with this girl and she rejected me. And like, you don't do that. So.
None of that. But, no. One thing that you said about, which seems to me that kind of shows love, is this question of time, that you actually devote time. You said about, you know, dating, you know, if someone spends a few hours with you, that's a big deal. So time is so valuable because, you know, life is also short, especially in this context, in the story. So giving anyone time is a huge gift, the gift of time, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say more than a few hours, but like, I mean, I've had dates that, you know, that started at like after work, 6 or 7 or 8, and it was like, oh, let's just get, you know, coffee or drinks or whatever, and it ended up being to like 3 in the morning. We're like walking down the street, and it's like, oh, like, you know, time kind of flew. But the thing is that, like, you know, particularly in the big cities like Japan, like in Tokyo or Osaka, they're very fast moving cities, right? It's easy to get from place to place, but it can still be time consuming. And so this idea of giving time to someone, especially when there are so many other people, so many other demands on your time, so many other things that you could be doing, right? I mean, if you know, there's a lot to do in Japan. There's a lot, right? They don't have to spend time with you. And to be truthful, they tend to, you know, people in Japan tend to choose their company based upon their interests. More so than, I mean, it's like, I'm not going to take you to go to the golf driving range if I know that you're just going to goof off and you're not going to enjoy it, right? I'm not going to take you to Jimbocho, the bookstores in Jimbocho, if I know that you're not really much of a reader, right? And so this idea of time plus interest is very important. But I think that when people invite you into those spaces and they're unsure of how you're going to react to it, because that happens all the time, That's also a sign. They're saying, I'm going to spend time with you doing this thing I'm not even sure you're really into, and I think you would be wise to reciprocate and take it seriously and show interest if you're interested in that person.
Oh, yes. I thought it was kind of funny that you mentioned baths, because the bathing is such a big theme in Shogun. And partly because, you know, Anjin is not, he's dirty and he never bathes. He doesn't quite understand why you have to wash yourself.
Right.
But then also that these baths, when you said that you don't necessarily have to speak, I think there were some scenes where, oh, let's just like go into one of those hot tubs or hot springs and just sit, you know, be there in the water, you know. Mm.
Yes. Yeah. I've been to onsens in Japan. I've been to quite a few of them, and they are segregated, right? Like, you have like the women's side, and the men's side, typically segregated. And, but they are public, right? So you're going to be in like an area with a bunch of other dudes who are like, you know, in a towel or nothing at all. But there is an element of, even though they're segregated, like I went with a close friend of mine. I went with her and her parents to an onsen, and even though they were segregated, they're by like a fence. They were like talking to each other over the fence, right? Like they were like he was in the spring and on his side, and she was in the spring on her side, and he was like laying back and he had the towel over his face, and he's like, hey, are you doing okay over there? And like she would answer, and like, and the funny thing about that is, and they were like in their 60s, right? which is also this kind of, again, this intimacy, right? This love of, you know, we're separated by this fence, but we're still sharing this communal experience.
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
And I found that very cute.
Oh, that is super cute. I agree. That's super cute. These moments we see. I was thinking like one moment which for me seemed to be like a moment where two kinds of love develop. Partly the connection between Anjin and Toranaga, Lord Toranaga, but also Mariko, is when Toranaga wants him to teach him how to swim. So he keeps kind of asking him to jump off this ship and then swim and swim back, just observing them. Can you touch upon that scene? Because it seemed to me that's this triangle between them, and she's observing the two guys, you know, having this moment, and she's enjoying it so much, you know, that kind of affection. Yeah, yeah.
I really enjoyed that scene too, because there was this element of levity, right, which I think was needed at that moment, which again, a testament to the writing. Excuse me, and I think that this, it's funny because out of all the scenes, I 100% agree with you. There is this sort of fraternal, and it really amongst the three of them, but in particular between Toranaga and Blackthorn, because I thought while he was diving in, they showed him diving in over and over and over again. I thought Toranaga was just messing with him.
I thought that too.
Right. Yeah. And so then when Toranaga finally dove in, I got that there was a connection.
Yes.
Right. And then when he was like, "Hey, let's race to the shore," you know, like that was very fraternal. It was very like, "We're going to have a friendly race, right, as brothers to the shore." Like, and also in that moment, because I mean, think about this too. This is what I got from it anyway, and maybe I read too deeply into things, but because it was kind of confirmed for me when Mariko says, "Don't just let him win," because he hates that. But those kinds of things are great equalizers. In that moment when they were diving and swimming, he was not, you know, a lord, and Blackthorn was not a lowly sailor. They could both drown, they could both swim, they could both, you know what I mean, each according to their abilities. They both could have gotten ashore, and one, you know what I mean. So in that moment, to me, they were equals, and I think that the writing demonstrated that there was a kind of kinship.
Oh yes, because at first it looked a little bit like one of those. That he's kind of bullying him a bit, that he's kind of messing
right.
with him, having fun, you know, it's like, oh, you know, and you know, the fact that he never suspected that. I also like
right.
that Blackthorn never really like, oh, I think he's messing with me. No, he was like dead serious. I'm going to do this a million times, you know,
right.
as long as he asks me. And there is something in that consistency of delivering, you know, like jump now, you know, jump, jump, jump. And Mariko is observing this and appreciating the fact that he's accepting this, you know, that he's honoring that entire scene, and so that's why she also teaches him that final move in the end, so that she understands that he got everything else, but he might miss this part. So I need to teach him the narrative
right.
here. I need to, you know, and he listens to her, and so all of that kind of, yeah.
I want to, and this may not be as popular with some of your viewers, but even being a Stoic, I'm still also deeply at heart a bit of a romantic. So I have to touch upon this aspect of love that I feel like it's omnipresent, but I think often untalked about, which is the idea of fated love. Because the idea of fate is something that Mariko touches upon repeatedly, right? Toranaga talks about fate. Even when he's talking to the woman from the courtesan house, they talk about fate. And the thing is that there are people, I believe, that we are, whether we even know them or not, that we are inextricably linked to. Inextricably, right? And I think that was bore out in the show by the fact that Blackthorn basically never left Japan. He was inextricably, and not just because of his fate, right? He was inextricably tied to Toranaga, right? To Toranaga. He was tied to Mariko, and even though Mariko died, I think she understood that connection because she ultimately gave her life for him, right? And so I think that we too frequently dismiss these things that are intangible, whether you want to call it, the universe or the cosmos or God or faith or whatever. I do think that there are people in our lives that we see them and we know instantly if they're going to be important to us. Do you know what I mean? And I think, again, with Todanaga, when he was unearthed from that earthquake and he looked up and he kind of had that brief smile, yes. He's like, of course it was you. It wasn't going to be anybody else. That's right. Yeah. And so I think that the idea of fated love, I think it's an essential theme of the show.
Yes. Oh, that is so beautiful. I agree with you absolutely, because it is there with all of those that there's like this sense like, okay, well, this guy really is connected to us on a deeper level. So even when Toranaga says that he's just kind of using him, or that he is that is just like kind of pawn in his plot, and all those things that he's kind of showing to. I think underneath, and this smile, this very subtle smile that you refer to, is for me a sign that there's something much deeper that he understands about that. Really, so it's not just this cold calculation that he is controlling the fate, but he is really this following fate, right? Mm.
I mean, it's confirmed by Mariko when she talks about, and Mariko and I think Hodamatsu and I think even Todanaga talk about, yeah, their secret heart, right? It's the part of them that they don't show to anybody, right? And I think that one of the reasons why, even though Todanaga sort of smirked a little bit, it was immediately went back to, it's because that was, his love for Blackthorn was part of that secret part. Because he didn't have to make Blackthorn a Hatamoto, right? Just one of the things that he relied upon was just Blackthorn's presence upended the order of things in his favor, potentially. And so he could have just said, yeah, just keep the guy and, give him a little apartment and, whatever. You know what I mean? But he, elevated him. So I think that there was a secret part of him with Mariko, right? There was a secret part of her, which didn't come out until the end. And so that, by the way, I love that. But I also want to say, being the I won't say I'm a romantic, but not a hopeless one, which is that these fated connections, they're very strong, and I think we all know them, even though we deny them. But I think that denying them can be incredibly destructive, right? And I think in the show it was. I mean, whether we can say they were directly or not, but I think pulling away from those things creates this tension that when things snap, it just creates chaos. And I think that even though for the purposes of the show, the resistance that Mariko and Blackthorn had towards each other really intensified the show, it made it more enjoyable. I think that the fact that it was unrequited essentially until she died was not a coincidence, right?
That it wasn't a coincidence, yeah. How did you interpret that scene where she is about to commit or do seppuku, and he is the one who accepts this task to really cut her head off? I mean, that was really intense.
You see these these period war movies, right, where two generals fight each other, or two, commanders, and one of them loses, and as he's about to die, he looks up at his enemy and he says, I'm glad it was you, right? Like, out of all the people that could have been, and I think it's that, but when you add in the sort of romantic love, right, where he's like, if anybody's going to cut your head off, it's going to be me, right? Because yes. I love you, right?
Yes.
You're not going to get your head cut off by somebody who doesn't care about you. You're going to get your head cut off with care,
yes.
And let me just say for the moment, I've never cut anybody's head off before, but I want to tell you that cutting somebody's head off with the sword, even a really sharp one, is not as easy as they make it look, right? There is a guy named Yukio Mishima in Japan who in the 50s led a revolt against the Japanese government, was cornered in the Defense Forces offices, and had his lover try to cut his head off. And when they found his body, they just found a bunch of these really deep cuts. Like, he didn't successfully. So, like, when you see it in a show, it's, they make it, like, they're like, wow, that's really gruesome that he cut his head off in one swing. I'm like, no, man, that's actually, that was actually pretty neat. Anyway, so going back to your question, I just had to sort of mention that. But it also feeds into this idea of his willingness to actually inflict permanent harm on her for her own sake. But on a deeper level, I think he came to understand her. I think he came to understand why she was doing what she's doing, why she did everything she did in her life, why she made the choices that she made. And I think he also understood that paradoxically, those choices that she made led her to him, even if those choices ultimately were going to take her from him. Do you know what I mean? And so I think him cutting her head off, as toxic as it sounds, was like a final act of intimacy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the it is so intense, exactly, because it is one of those moments where you both you know that love is this ultimate gift of yourself, in a sense, but you also know that you don't have yourself. Like, you are giving yourself, but you don't have yourself, because you really are being made in that moment. So Anjan Blackthorne he really comes to be the person she can love, and know that this is real love, that it is really authentic, that he knows her that deeply, that he knows that deep heart that you talked about.
Absolutely.
But it's also that moment where he could pretty much lose her.
Yes.
So that's why it is so beautiful and so authentic. I would say.
I would hope that no one in modern times has. Go ahead.
Yeah, I hope you meet. Of course. No. I would chopping off hands, but I mean symbolical. Right. Of course, it shows something there. And what you said about the that how hard it is to actually do it. To perform something like that, of course, it looks so clean and quick and it's almost like aesthetic, right? But I think that's probably why they had this memory of Toranaga when he was younger, and when this myth of him cutting someone's head off as a young boy with one clean shot or something like that, right? Yeah.
The thing about if there was going to be a weapon that could cut someone's head clean off with one stroke, it would be a katana. And a 12-year-old, would a 12-year-old have the strength to do that? I would probably say probably not. Yeah. But the thing about katana wielding is it's not about raw arm strength, right? Mm. There's like hip and so it's conceivable that he could have cut somebody's head off. Conceivable. I won't say probable. But the interesting thing is that I forgot what I was going to say, but yeah, I mean, when I saw that part and they're talking about that in the story, I was like, could he have done that? Yeah, maybe, but maybe not. So
well, maybe not. Yeah. And then they bring it up late. And also the fact that I forget his name, who also in the end sacrificed himself for Toranaga, that he was the one who knew that it was a myth, you know,
Uematsu.
Yes, that's right.
He was one of my favorite characters.
Oh, so good. I was just like, insane.
Very few lines, but when he delivered lines, he made them count, right?
Yeah, so everything, like every second, he made every second count. Like, but he was like, I was like, I stopped breathing. You know, I cannot breathe. And I'm just like, what is going to happen now? Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but please.
No, I was just going to, again, I'm sort of like, my thoughts are just kind of everywhere. But I think this is a really great show to sort of deconstruct this idea of love. And I think it's interesting because one of the things that I wanted to mention that it just finally came back to me is, how people address or talk to each other. Right. Like there are honorific titles and things like that. but within a certain, when you're above a certain rank, right, to a Westerner, it might appear that they're all basically the same, right? And one of the things that I wanted to sort of talk about was familial bonds, right? Because many of these noble families are related to each other, if not by birth, by marriage. But they all occupy different stations within the hierarchy. And I remember there was a scene, I forget what his name is, but I think the nephew of Yabushige was talking to somebody, and that person kind of rebuked him, and he immediately stopped and bowed and walked off. And it reminded me of something my grandmother had said to me once was, you know, when I made my first trip to Osaka, she says, be very careful who you talk to and how. Right. And I was, and I, at first I didn't understand. I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, people can appear to be this thing or that thing to you. And they may be that thing to you, but their cousin, their uncle, their father, their nephew could be somebody entirely different to you. And you have to think that when you talk to people, you have to immediately assess that person, who they are, and all their relationships and how they're related to you before you open your mouth. And the interesting thing is how frequently, and I thought like, okay, maybe some of the audience may not get this, but how frequently that was done in the show, right? How frequently that calculation had to be made. And I was like, man, that's stressful.
That is,
you know.
Yes. Can you give an example of a scene, of a nice scene that exemplifies that?
It was a scene with Yabushige's nephew. I can't remember who he was talking to, but it came out that who he was talking to was the grandfather. I think it was Odomatsu's, like someone related to Odomatsu, and I was like, wow. You know, he really came back to himself quickly. I may be butchering it, but I remember that scene because he stopped and he bowed, like, okay, I have to shut my mouth now. And that's what really drove it home for me. I was like, he just made that calculation in his mind.
Oh,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And realized that he was not, even though formally his station was above that of the person he was talking to, like he was the lord of this area, he was talking to somebody who's uncle outranked him.
Yes.
Right? And I was like, oof, okay. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
And this is definitely right, because there are all these scenes when something is happening, like you think, well, they are thinking quite a lot. There's a lot of calculation going on in their minds. And, you know, we may not always understand what exactly it is that they're calculating, but you know that they are. So every gesture is, you know, really deeply thought through.
Mm. And the same thing with Toranaga, even though he's at the apex of the strata, and you would think just because he has to deal with the Council of Regents that his movements are limited. And it's like, no, because he's the person moving the chess pieces, right? You know that the rook can only move in one direction, the bishop can only move in one direction. So you look at all these people who you are related to by marriage and blood, how they're going to aid your ascension. But you recognize that they too have their own games they're playing, and they also are limited, you know, by their station, the number of troops they have, etc. And so he's got that going on all the time, right? Like he probably lives that 24/7.
Yeah, yes, that's the impression I get, that he is really looking at the really huge chessboard and considering all kinds of, it's like a huge algorithm that he needs.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Because
I think they did a great job with the portrayals.
Yeah. So true. And also the way I feel that seemed to me that, of course, you know, love, there is the politics of love, and there's so much sacrifice. I mean, it's like every kind of love goes with some kind of sacrifice, that it maybe, you know, that it demands sacrifice, or at least readiness at sacrifice.
Yeah, and I think, again, I'm going to play like the old man screaming at clouds, and say it's something that I feel that a lot of people in modern times have lost. I, you know, like there is, again, this hyper individualism. You know, to me, if you're, whether it's fated love or love that you've encountered, you A, have to accept the person as they are, love them as they are, completely as they are. You have to, you know, it is acceptance, right? But then you also have to commit yourself to navigating the circumstances that you both find yourselves in, right? Someone gets sick, someone's family member gets sick, someone's children get sick. You know, it also means, you know, equitably dividing labor. You know, that person does all these things for you that you never, that you don't really necessarily see, you know? And so I think that, like, and yeah, the roles in Shogun were very gendered. There's no doubt.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Like the Kiyama, you know, she was the house, you know, manager. Right. And by the way, I just have to tell you, like, the scene where her, with her and the gun, oh man,
oh, that was the scene. Gas. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Where she was like, thank you for your visit. Right. And she pointed the gun at, and the scene with Mariko, right. And the Naginata, her, like, using the spear, the halberd. So, like, which also, again, like, there's that, like people think that duty and love are disparate things. And I don't necessarily agree. I think that duty absolutely can arise from love, and honestly, vice versa. And so, yeah, that's all I have to say about that. Like, I just think that, you know, I don't, I look at these shows and I don't get caught up in the romanticization of, like, the war and, like, the being a samurai. I get caught up in the romanticization of these levels of dedication that these people have to each other, right? That's what really kind of gets me.
Yeah, me too. That's why this show was so fascinating to me. Just a detail, like the old man, the gardener, I think, who takes off the pheasant, the rotting bird. You know, I mean, just
Wedgido, yeah.
So, yeah, just that. I mean,
that was. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's just that sacrifice and all that and what it meant, and, you know, when Anjin, you know, doesn't quite understand what just happened, you know, and
It's funny too, because I think a lot of, again, something else I saw people commented on a lot about this idea that Wejiro, like, this idea that you, that when you say something in Japan, right, it has, like, you know, it had meaning because he said it. That's what Mariko said. But also, people didn't understand the sacrifice that Wejiro made, right? That these ideas of, you know, tatagaramis and like evil spirits and stuff, these or discord, what they call, is something that is considered to be not only pervasive but infectious, right? And you are living in a place that is precarious, that's just suffered from a catastrophe, that is on the verge of a war, and you have the household of somebody who's very important that is in disarray. That is not a good, like, people, you know, it's like, oh, so you're going to kill yourself for that? Yes. Yes. That's what he did. He killed himself to restore harmony to the household. Right. And that's exactly what happened. Right. And people miss that.
That really didn't go unnoticed. Like, when I was watching it, I thought that was so strong. But I do love that they want to see, like, from, you know, his point of view, oh, it is kind of really meaningless, that and so. But when you really think about it, it's extremely important. It's so much more meaningful than anything else. You know?
Yes.
That kind of commitment, that love of that, you know, health of that that community. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do want to comment also on really quickly about this idea of, like, living in the moment, which is another big theme, because on the one hand, they're constantly in weighing the repercussions and consequences of the things that they say and do, while simultaneously insisting that they have to live in the moment, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a paradoxical, you know, two paradoxical beliefs you have to hold. And yeah, I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, that's, I love that thought, absolutely, because it seems the paradox is what keeps it together. I would like to end on the role of poetry.
Oh, yes.
I think, I mean, that was the way they use poetry, the way, you know, Mariko is this ultimate poet, you know, everyone envies her skills. And so many scenes of these connections where they have these really meaningful exchanges where they are, you know, they're composing poets on spontaneously, like, you know, someone, you know, starts a line and you continue it, you know, that's such, you know, like in the tea ceremony, then with the Taranaga, then with the former emperor's wife, concubine, you know, at the castle, you know, so many scenes with poetry that all carrying different meaning, but also a kind of consistent use of poetry in the way they are. I would really love to hear your thoughts on that.
You know, Japanese is a very poetic language, and it's again something that's lost in a lot of people. Poetry, first of all, is a courtly art. It's something that was practiced in the post, what they call the post Sekigahara, the post-warring state, Sengoku Jidai. It was practiced by samurai a lot in the post-Jidai era, so Sengoku Jidai era. But there's also this other element, which is called Jisei, which is literally death poetry, right? And it's this idea of, like, you hit upon something that's very, very close to me, because I'm like a death poetry, like, fanatic, right? Like, I don't like sit around reading it all day, but I search out forms of it to see. And there is this kind of, I don't want to say obsession, but this kind of fixation on letting the world know how you felt about the way you lived your life or the way that you died by your last words, right? And so very frequently you have jiseis that were written or uttered by monks on their deathbeds, right? Or by taishos, daimyos, taikos on their deathbeds. On a very rare occasion, I think you may have had some like samurai who's like laying in the blood and guts of a battle and he's got a sword through him and he's dying. I think that's kind of the romance that the romanticism that's kind of peddled with jisei, but I guess my point is, and if you looked at the last samurai, right, Ken Watanabe, he utters a jisei before he dies. He utters a death poem in that. And so so I think that, like, if you live in this culture and you recognize that the slightest insult could mean your death, or the slightest insult of someone you serve could mean your death, then this idea of poetry is sort of inextricably intertwined with that, right? But if you also look at things like, I'm a big Akira Kurosawa fan, right? And his movies, even though they, you know, his movies have a lot to do with like nature, right? And themes and those kinds of themes. If you see a lot of his films, things like Snowfall and Rain and Waterfalls, they're very prominent. I mean, even they're in the background, which in itself is another form of poetry. So poetry is something that's very ingrained in the Japanese culture and their language. And this idea of using rhetoric, not just for the sake of being clever, but for saying something beautiful, right? They, like, Japanese have this really deep appreciation for beautiful stuff, you know, whether it's words or paintings or films. Like, so when you say something, and it's not like you walk around saying deep stuff, right? It's, but when it's time to say that kind of stuff, it's important that you say something that's meaningful.
Yes.
So yeah, that's like,
and that is remembered, because in many of those scenes, like, oh, you know, I remember she said that, you know, and that was, and if someone says something, and it's like, oh, that's not really your line. That really comes. You recognize the signature, and,
yeah.
That it really comes authentically from another heart, you know, from another mind, you know, someone who is thinking on it, and there, I felt that with poetry, with the way the poetry was put into play. That these things with hierarchies and the rank and the lineage and all that was almost cancelled, or almost kind of, because, like, you know, when Toranaga and Mariko have these exchanges, and he recognizes that she is superior to him in poetry, and he enjoys that. He loves that. So he is superior in every other way, but she is the superior poet, and he appreciates that in a way that is just stunningly beautiful.
Yes. I do want to mention one other instance where that was, I felt significant, and that was when Yabushige had one of Blackthorne's men boiled alive.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And he had his, I don't know if it was his son or his, you know, one of his attendants, but he was like, recite a poem.
Yes.
And he recited, I was like, he's going to have this guy deliver it, like a death poem? Like, really? You know, while this guy's outside boiling alive, which I have to say that scene bothered me, and not because of the abject violence, but because they just threw him into a pot, just tied up. It was very, anyway. So I wanted to mention that recitation because it was significant. It said something to me about Yabushige that, like, I really thought that he was just mindlessly cruel, and I was surprised to find out later on that he was, that, you know, that maybe he was, but there was something redeeming in him.
Yes, because he writes his death poem in the end, right, which is then read out loud and appreciated, and which gives meaning to him, redeems him from this, like, treachery or the betrayal of his lord, you know, so that the poem kind of redeems him and gives him back his honor. Yeah.
And he was one of the more, I will have to say, he was one of the more complex characters. I actually liked his character. Because I really don't think that he was being treacherous out of his, and please forgive me for being a treachery apologist, but I don't think that he was necessarily being treacherous out of a sense of wanting to betray Toranaga. I think he was being treacherous because he found himself at a station where almost anything that he did was going to mean his death, right? And so he had to play the situation just right. And it still meant his death. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it was like, he was like middle management, you know, and those guys very rarely get promoted, like, to upper management.
That's right.
So...
That's absolutely right. But also in that moment when he's betrayed them, and there is a big scene, there's a lot of murder, and of course the explosion, and Mariko's death, and you could see also in the way he communicated with them, you know, that it was quite deep and complex, the whole thing. A lot of things were probably left unsaid, mm-hmm. that we don't quite know what they meant, or that we really need to. And for me, for instance, I'm going to go back and listen to this poem that you just mentioned, because that was a little bit lost on me. Because it was so much in the beginning that I didn't kind of register it. But I like kind of, if I rewatch it, I think it'll be far more meaningful. Yeah, that was a great note.
Great. I am so honored to have had the opportunity to discuss this show with you.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, this was I think, yeah, this was in a sense fate, in the way, because we don't know each other, and the thing is that I was really burning, I was like really trying to find, you know, someone to talk to about this, and I was like, who could it be? And then I just reached out to our friend, and she said, no, I know the perfect guy, you know, so that was really amazing. And thank you so much, John, for this.
Well, I hope that I provided a worthy conversation with you on this.
Well, you most certainly did. I loved it, and I think our viewers will enjoy it as well. I think there's quite a lot of that.
Great. I enjoy it. I enjoy it immensely. And I feel very privileged to have been invited. I really appreciate you inviting me on your podcast.